Senate Environment, Energy, and Natural Resources Budget Division will come to order. We're going to start with some testimony carried over from the last hearing, so we appreciate people's flexibility. And we know members will be arriving very soon to listen. So we'll bring up Ron. Is Ron Harnack here? I don't know if you want to fill in all the seats, Daryl Gerber, Steve Thorne. If you'd like to all come up at once, that would be fine. Or if you'd prefer not to, that's fine, too. Senator Dunn, we'll invite you up if you all want to pull up chairs. Did Steve Thorne come back? He may not have because he did testify. Anyway, all right, welcome to the committee, Mr. Harnack.
Madam Chair and committee members, thank you. My name is Ron Harnack. I'm representing the Red River Watershed Management Board. And I would like to provide some comments on the moving of EQB to PCA and ask that you consider some alternatives. I would ask that consideration be given to putting the surface and groundwater coordination and planning responsibilities of EQB into the Board of Water and Soil Resources rather than PCA. Why do this? There is currently some redundancy in the responsibilities of EQB and Bowser with respect to the interagency coordination of water. If you look at 103B, 101. Bowser has the authority to coordinate water and soil resources planning and implementation of watershed districts, WMOs, soil and water districts, counties, cities. And Bowser has the authority for the facilitation and coordination among state agencies in support of local water management efforts. Bowser has the membership to make this approach very successful. Bowser membership includes PCA, DNR, Health, Ag, University of Minnesota Extension, counties, water management organizations, watershed districts, soil and water districts, and citizens. If proposed legislation passes, cities and townships would also be formal members of the Board of Water and Soil Resources. Bowser also has the responsibility and authority for addressing water disputes broadly across a number of different statutes to hear and resolve disputes, appeals, and interventions under 103A, which is water policy, 103B, water planning, 103D, which is watershed districts, and 103G, which is other broad water and land-related management activities. There's been continual discussion regarding the water agency's organization or reorganization, yet over the years, there have been only minor tweaks that have improved effectiveness and efficiencies and built stronger bonds, I think, between state and local governments that are critical to achieving Minnesota's water management goals and outcomes. Placing the EQB Water Planning Authority in Bowser would be another tweak that would consolidate state and local water planning under one roof rather than perpetuating segregation or, in fact, expanding the duplication and potential conflict since agencies do not sit on PCA. If this option were to be done, it would be appropriate to also transfer the appropriate FTE and budget to Bowser along with such a transition. On the environmental review responsibilities of EQB to PCA, we do not have very strong feelings, although the authority and responsibility of EQB has not changed significantly over time. And the perceived role and maybe the actual role of EQB appears to have diminished in terms of its leadership role in big picture future issues like climate change, nuclear energy, and so forth. In terms of environmental review, maybe the change will not have any significant impact as that transition would take place. In fact, there may be some efficiencies in the process depending on how much emphasis is continued to put on environmental review when it moves into PCA. However, we are concerned with the move to PCA that there may be significant loss of interagency coordination that can be critical to project environmental review. You get one biased perspective. You have ag projects moving forward and only have a PCA perspective or a regulatory perspective. What happens to ag? What about some of the other related interagency issues? One sole purpose agency guiding the effort may not be what is intended, but what could occur. That could create more conflict rather than promoting improvements in the process when interagency coordination is lacking. However, with budget constraints, as you move forward, some of these issues may be the lesser of two evils in the short run. In closing, we would hope you'd give serious consideration to moving the water planning responsibilities to Bowser, and I think we need to look at the long-term role of what is EQB supposed to look like for the future. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be happy to try to answer any questions if I can.
Thank you, Mr. Harnack. And you're testifying on your own today, or?
Madam Chair, I'm testifying on behalf of the Red River Watershed Management Board.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Thank you for your comments. Appreciate that very much. Mr. Gerber, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Daryl Gerber. I am a program coordinator with Clean Water Action in Minnesota. And I thank you for allowing me to come speak today, and I'm speaking in opposition to the elimination of the Environmental Quality Board. And mainly there's two main points that I'd like to touch on. One of them is the oversight role that this board does perform, and that this cannot really be actually adequately taken up by any other agency. And the other one is the coordination role. As far as the oversight, one of the important roles it plays is actually ensuring that other agencies comply with state environmental policy. And, you know, that's something that it is very hard to see how that can be taken up by an agency such as PCA or Bowser or wherever it may go, that would actually have oversight over all of the other agencies. There's not just the mechanics of it, but also the kind of changing the fundamental relationship between the agencies. The other part is an environmental review itself, is that some of the other agencies, such as PCA, the Pollution Control Agency, also do environmental review of themselves in different cases that they may be the agency or the governmental unit that has jurisdiction. And so it doesn't really work to have the PCA have oversight over itself. The other point to that is that is the expertise that's required to actually give good oversight. And I think that gets into some of the points that Mr. Harnack mentioned, in that by having a board like the Environmental Quality Board that combines the expertise of multiple agencies, you can actually provide a better quality of oversight on environmental review, because you get a whole different set of eyes looking at something rather than this kind of siloing of the expertise into the different environmental reviews. On the question of coordination, I think this is one of the really important roles that the EQB does play, and that's that it's actually one of the few times that the agency heads get together and kind of talk about and look at what different actions, different roles each of the projects the agencies are working on, and where there are opportunities to coordinate, both for cost savings that is achieved by coordinating, as well as actually being able to perform those functions better. I think that really comes down to another thing, too, is that as far as the cost savings, I don't have any answers on this, but I think it would be really worth looking into, and is to what amount of cost savings is achieved by the coordination role, where you have all of the agencies actually working together, talking about how they can better perform their functions cooperatively at a lower cost. So, you know, in the name of kind of trying to cut down inefficiencies, I think that that's also the other side of the picture that has to be looked at. And, you know, I think some examples of where this is, it could better be used rather than the way it has in the past, is looking at some of these big interagency problems like global warming, Right now, a lot of the response is directed through just the Department of Commerce, through the Office of Energy Security. But this is really a problem. You know, actually, how do we achieve these reductions is something that applies across the entire state's suite of agencies. And it's really something that I think that we should be asking the EQB to take on a bigger role in coordinating the response to this problem. And with that, I'll conclude my comments and stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Gerber. Questions? Comments? Thank you very much for your testimony. Oh. Welcome. Oh, Mr. Gerber.
I did just want to bring out there is a letter that is being handed out right now. It's from a number of organizations that are members of the Minnesota Environmental Partnership, also kind of laying out some of the same points in opposition to limiting.
Great. Thank you very much. And members, that's just been passed around to all of us. Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Senator Dunn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Bob Dunn. In 1973, all that time ago, I was the chief author of the Minnesota Environmental Policy Act, which brought about the creation of the EQB. I had additional experience with the EQB by being appointed as a citizen member by Governor Perpich and later as chair by Governor Carlson. I'm here to oppose Section 20 of Article 3 of this 1395, eliminating the EQB and transferring its duties and functions to the Pollution Control Agency. This whole thing misses the point that the EQB was a coordinating body that was made up of nine agencies and citizen members, and to give this responsibility to one of the nine defeats really the whole purpose, or much of the purpose, of the EQB, and it doesn't make a bit of sense to me. And as far as if it's something about savings, that doesn't work either, because the total minuscule staff of the EQB and all its whatever it has in the way of resources is transferred to the BCA. So the bill states that the purpose of this thing is to improve the efficiency of state government by concentrating the environmental and educational activities of the EQB in one agency. And that, of course, is contrary to the basic idea that the EQB is made up of all nine agencies who have major responsibilities in the area of environmental policy and activities. And both Mr. Harnack and Mr. Gerber referred to this. I won't dwell on it a lot longer, but I think that particular point is probably the main reason that this is not a good idea. In addition, we have the responsibilities of the board and environmental policy guidance and oversight that takes in a broader scope than the narrower responsibilities of the PCA. It has conducted and should conduct the environmental review program. And here again, you may have a conflict if it's in the PCA because you have one rather narrower point of view. Strategic planning on a major scale has been referred to, and that's something that involves the interests and the expertise of more than just one of the members of the board. Same with major policy development for the state. And some of this is going on now with the state water plan and in the past the timber study and many other things that the board has accomplished. Another unique aspect of the EQB is the fact that citizens are involved. It provides a forum for more citizen input into these issues that are not related just to one agency, but to the whole broad spectrum of environmental concerns. And it's a place where the commissioners of all the other agencies are available, in a sense, to the public more so than in their sort of sequestered roles in their own little kingdoms. I think it's important not to diminish the activities of the EQB. It's what we should really do is look at how we can improve and revitalize this, what I consider, critical element of state government. I think that getting away from this whole thing, which seems a little precipitous, and having at some point a study that will look at what needs to be done to improve the board. Resources, appropriations have been, and staff have been cut back recently. And in order to have the board function the way it was intended, I think improvements and embellishments to what's going on need to be done. I think the whole idea of environmental policy originated from a joint legislative committee interim study in between the 71 and 73 sessions. Something like that could be done, or a blue ribbon commission, which would include legislators and advocates and academics, might be another one. These things are things that would not destroy, as this proposal would do, but would make more efficient board and be a wonderful thing for the mission that was envisioned. And it seems to me that in this time when environmental issues are becoming more important, when we have, in effect, issues and challenges that threaten the whole life of the planet, to say nothing of the state of Minnesota, and following the November endorsement by the public of spending money on the environment and moving ahead with environmental concerns in the election on the amendment, I think it just sort of beats me why the proposal that this section makes is even being considered. And I hope that you may be able to end that to accomplish the elimination of the proposal rather than the elimination of the EQB. I don't know if anybody has any questions.
Thank you very much. Do you think that the Department of Administration is the right place, given that we don't have a planning agency and, you know, given current circumstances, for the EQB to exist?
Madam Chair, no. It was an expedient, I think, at the demise of the state planning agency. I think really my feeling has been, and I tried to have that accomplished, Senator Merriam and I worked on that for some time, to have a freestanding EQB, one that would not be, you don't get to the right legislative committees. It's certainly a side interest of Department of Administration. And it doesn't seem that it really fits within any department. The housing of the EQB is certainly something that should be looked at.
All right. Thank you. And thank you, Senator Dunn, for your leadership in the 1970s that is still, I mean, the legacy that you left is still, it's still strong in our law book. So thank you for your work.
Thank you.
Any other comments or questions? Thank you for testifying today. Appreciate
Madam
it.
Chair.
Senator Vickerman.
Madam Chair, I'm trying to find any kind of money I can find for savings. So I'm not so sure how I'm even going to vote on this yet, but I'd like to know what we're saving. It's just nothing. Before we finish, I'd like to know.
On the EQB proposal, I don't know that it – is there an elimination of some staff in the transfer, or is there a savings counted in the transfer? I can't remember. All right, Mr. Mueller, can you help with that?
Madam Chair and Senator Vickerman, the way the tracking actually works is we wouldn't actually see the savings in this budget division. The savings were sort of captured over in the State Department's area. So if we actually do the transfer, they would have a little bit of net savings. But in our area, it wouldn't help with our budget at all.
Well, because they're moving the staff over
right.
that they have. It's, you know, small, but that would be within the PCA then. So it's not really... there's no real net budget impact to the overall state budget?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Schirkenbach's up. Maybe we should ask him. All right. Mr. Schirkenbach, will you give us more insight into this, please?
Yeah, Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tim Schirkenbach. I'm Deputy Commissioner of the Pollution Control Agency. Again, just to clarify the facts as far as the transfer, there is basically two and a half positions that are coming across to the agency. The administration would take credit for a reduction of a person and a half in administration, so roughly $150,000 a year savings in administration. We actually get four people coming across, two and a half positions, so we'd have to absorb and look for other spots for some of those people to be working. And part of this is building off of what Mr. Dunn said. The reality is, yeah, as far as huge amount of money, I don't think anybody says it's a huge amount, although Commissioner Badgerow has talked to administration, given their small budget, any little thing helps on them meeting some of the reductions they have to deal with in the general fund. So this helps them to some extent on that. The reality is the overall number of positions now in the EQB are dealing with all these issues with four people. The efficiency really is where we can help, even though we're only getting two and a half positions, both on providing assistance to local government on environmental review issues. We can have some of our people augment that effort, and then also on water planning and other things. We already have a number of people involved, 300 people involved in water issues, given all of our responsibilities under the Clean Air Act. So that helps in that area.
Thank you very much, Mr. Schirkenbach. Appreciate it. All right, another issue for us to grapple with. All right, let's move on down the agenda, unless Steve Thorne is not here, I take it. He did testify last week, so. All right, thank you all for your input on that important issue. We really appreciate it. Senator Prettner-Solon.
Madam Chair,
welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, committee members, Senate File 2029 appropriates $300,000 to the University of Minnesota Duluth for the Natural Resources and Research Institute to develop statewide heat flow maps. And before I present the bill, I would like to move the A1 amendment. This is an author's amendment that changes the appropriation from a general fund appropriation to an appropriation from the Renewable Development Fund.
All right, let's wait till everybody has it. Does everyone have the amendment over there?
I don't think it's gotten over here yet.
Okay. all right, on... on the Fredrickson motion, any questions? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no? Sorry, I pounded this just a moment too soon. Motion prevails. Senator Prettner-Solon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Geothermal energy is a clean, renewable, and consistent source of energy that has the capability to provide much of the nation's baseload electrical power and space heating needs. This bill will fund a study to provide detailed heat flow temperature maps to evaluate the feasibility of local geothermal energy production. This heat flow data is critical for determining the economics of installing geothermal power plants. And with me today is Don Fosnecht from the Center for Applied Research and Technology Development and Stephen Houck, Deputy Director from NRRI, from the University of Minnesota Duluth, and I would ask that they have a presentation.
Yes, let's bring it on.
How much time did you tell them? Who's first? Dr. Fosnecht?
Yes, I'm Dr. Don Fosnecht. I have been the co-lead for the energy section on the state conservation plan development and I'm currently a member of Governor Pawlenty's Collaborative on Clean Energy Technology. And what we'll do is go through some background information just to set the opportunity together for you, as well as what we see as the biggest obstacle for us to be successful. And in a nutshell, the current energy map for the state was produced largely from data from Lake Superior in what we think is a very erroneous data collection manner. And unfortunately for us, that has tainted the view for the whole state of Minnesota. And you'll see that when you see the particular energy map that we go through. So what I'm going to do is walk you through this to give you an idea. What is enhanced geothermal energy recovery? Why Senator Solon just mentioned we think it's an excellent opportunity for the future, and this will be to generate actual electricity and actually a community heat source for local heating as well. So let me see if I can get that.
Dr. Fosnack, we don't have an awful lot of time.
No, it'll be
so
a very
So we do want to hear
crisp.
This. It's very interesting, but we'll have to try to limit the amount of time we spend.
Okay. This is basically the conclusions from the current map for the state of Minnesota. Basically, if you look at the current map, we would not be a prime candidate for enhanced geothermal energy recovery. We wouldn't share in any of the commercialization ventures likely to occur over the next 10-year period in this area, and largely funded by the U.S. DOE. Even though we are a very stable geologic area with stable land masses and likely beneficial power users, we would not benefit from this particular technology if the existing map is basically left to be intact. And just showing you the map itself, if you look at this, it looks like there's basically no energy in the top part of Minnesota, and those of us who live up there sometimes feel it's that way. But in reality, we think that we should be very similar to our western and some of the southern neighbors. And the reason for this poor situation is because the data points that were taken were only 2.5 meters below the surface of Lake Superior for 90 of the data points. And that's there's a confounding influence of lake currents and things of that nature, which really mask good heat flow information for our area. And just to show you what the energy source will be, these are the energy sources. We have the core energy from the molten core of the Earth, as well as radioactive heat that is generated from certain elements in the Earth's crust. The combined energy that is emitted every day from the Earth's crust is 4 times that required to supply all the energy needs of the world today. So being able to tap into that energy source, we think, is a very important thing. So what this program involves is to generate a new heat flow map for the state. And we think a representative picture for the whole state, from the northwest to the southeast, all the way across the state, would take about 100 representative locations. We would cross the diversity of formations and terrains that we have within Minnesota, and that this would be done by qualified geologists and engineers basically to do the work. And what's involved in doing that work is basically to establish this bottom equation here, and that's the heat flow, which is taking the conductivity of the rock, the temperature difference that exists at different depths into the Earth's crust, and then actually calculating what that actual flow would be. Doing this work across the state would basically involve the different terrains that are shown in the next the top portion here, right in this area up on the top, the different rock types. As you can see, we have a variety of different rock conditions. And why that's important is some of that rock contains uranium, thorium, potassium, and other things that potentially can radioactively decay right in place. And that actually adds heat value to what is coming from the molten core.
Dr. Fosnack, is this in your handout?
It is in the presentation.
In that, this little, one. That Sorry, one right I've there. Lost you. Okay, go ahead, please.
So if you look at the match of the state rock types and then the drill holes and wells that are available for potentially going and doing this particular work, we have a fairly good match with available sites that can be used to go after and actually do this heat flow determination. So this project basically would allow us to get into the overall future scenario for enhanced geothermal energy production. Mm-hmm. Net results will be having a realistic understanding of our potential for the state. It is likely that we'll be more like the neighbors that I had cited earlier. And we could become a very significant EGS development opportunity because we have geologic stability, we have good groundwater resources, and we have high power use potential in this state relative to many other areas that also be investigating this. One of the earliest slides, which I didn't show because of time, cited the U.S. Department of Energy study that was conducted in 2007, which basically indicated that enhanced geothermal energy is one of the highest potential energy resources from a non-polluting standpoint that we have to address in this country. That study showed the cost of electricity ranging from roughly 3.2 cents per kilowatt hour to something like 9.6 cents, depending upon the location. Another factor, and you'll have another handout there, it's a large page showing a heat recovery system. There is the potential for actually using carbon dioxide from existing power plants to sequester and recover heat from using the CO2 as the heat media. So if that's the case, if you have the defined energy source, you can actually, on a very small footprint near an existing power plant, put some of these enhanced geothermal type systems and use the gases coming off of those systems after they've been captured and sequestered. So it's another way to help the environment from an environmental standpoint. In the supplemental information you have at the end of the presentation, it will cite the great reductions you have in terms of environmental impact with this technology, with water use, and also with the total amount of energy that's likely to exist within the continental U.S. boundaries if we really go after this particular resource, and that was the basic recommendation of the DOE study, that this really be something that we go after. Unfortunately for us, to participate, we need to have a realistic map for the state of Minnesota, and it does not exist today.
All right, thank you very much. Are there questions for Dr. Fosnack? Were you also going to speak,
no, I'm Mr. Howe? No, I'm here to answer questions, Madam Chair.
Okay. Well, this is Senator Prettner-Solin. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, not about this. I think this is a very exciting project, but I just recognize that Mike Lalich, who's the director of Natural Resources Research Institute, is in the audience, too.
Great. Thank you. This is this follows up from a discussion we had in the LCCMR about the potential, the incredible energy potential of this source. And we never did fund this project through the LCCMR, and so I'm really glad to have it come forward as a bill, because I think we need accurate information about Minnesota. And so you think there's good reason to believe that we have this geothermal heat source in our state? I mean, what's your basis for believing? I know you talked about some of the flaws of the mapping that was already done, but how do we know that we have a good chance of it here?
Well, one of the things that they missed entirely was those types of rocks. And actually, it's only one data point on a landmass in Minnesota that they used. So when you look at how they're interpreting the information, it is an extrapolation of bad data to a broad area. In fact, most of the data, even on Lake Superior, are really up in Michigan. Hmm. So if you look at that, we're being influenced by data that really does not represent the state. The other thing, because they did not go into the land masses that have a lot of our granites and other type of rock, which we know has radioactive elements in it, they missed that entire heat source as well. So they have, I think, one land sample that's in some sediment, and the rest of it basically can't be trusted. So Minnesota is basically going to be eliminated from consideration on essentially erroneous information.
And Dr. Fosnacht, is this something that is actually producing energy in some parts of the country right now?
Typically, it is used in a more shallow heat source basis out in the west. It is extensively being used and implemented today in Europe. There's probably 50 existing plants that drill down basically about 2 kilometers to 4 kilometers in depth, and they're producing 10 to 20 megawatts of electricity routinely today. So you can go to one of these plants, it may not look like a power plant because it's so small, over in Europe and actually see this being done.
And being done, it can be done now with today's technology?
With today's technology.
That you mentioned that.
Now, they have obviously some differences in their environmental and energy policies over in Europe. But they, within their constraints, they routinely produce economic electricity using the system.
And what's really significant also, members, about this is that it is a substitute for baseload power, so it's really available 24/7.
That's right. It just, the Earth is just keep giving you the energy. It keeps getting replenished from the Earth's interior.
The original
baseload. If you don't collect it
heat.
And use it, it's going to be going to space. That's the thing, catch it.
Senator Kubley.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and Dr. Fosnacht. Since it always comes up here, I wondered if you had a cost comparison from those plants where this form of energy is already being used.
All I can cite
Dr.
is the best study on that is the U.S. DOE study conducted by MIT,
okay.
And that's where they cited the costs are likely to be between 3.2 and 9.6 cents per kilowatt hour. That's their standard reference. They also cite in there the typical capital costs. I can tell you, compared to conventional power plants, the capital costs are significantly less.
So if we funded this mapping, this would complete the mapping that would be needed to allow a commercial endeavor to have enough information to move forward with developing one of these plants?
Yes.
Okay. Any other questions? Senator Fredrickson.
Madam Chair, Dr. Fosnacht, would you say again where you would do this exploration, what areas of the state?
We would do the whole state. We'd take 100 data points for the state, which I think will give a very adequate picture, and we'd go from the northwest across to the northeast, down to the southeast and southwest, and in the central parts of the state. There, if you saw the map on water wells that are available at depth, as well as drill holes that are available, we think there's good coverage and access to get at stable temperature environments with the existing holes that exist. And we would do this across the state because it's a state issue.
So you wouldn't have to drill new
holes? No, we would not. We'd take advantage of what holes exist. Locating those specific holes is part of the challenge. The data is available, then you have to search them out and find them.
And how deep do they have to be?
These holes that we're looking at are greater than 300 feet deep. So we want fairly deep holes because you get a much more stable picture of the heat flow of the Earth as you go deeper.
Senator Fredrickson.
Madam Chair, Dr. Fosnacht, when you say 300 feet, is that 300 feet from the top of, like, the granite shield, or 300 feet from the surface? From the surface.
All right. Very good. Any other questions? Anyone else like to be heard on Senate File 2029? Would someone like to move, Senator Kubley moves that Senate File 2029 be laid on the table for possible inclusion in the omnibus funding bill? On that motion, any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion fails. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Saxhaw, you ready to go?
Yeah.
Senator Fredrickson, would you mind sharing? Thank you.
Committee has before it Senate File 1677, the Mississippi Headwaters Board. Senator Saxhaw.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 1677 is the appropriation for the Mississippi Headwaters Board. The Mississippi Headwaters Board manages the first 400 miles of the Mississippi River corridor. And with me today is Aiken County Commissioner Brian Napstead, who is also the current chair of the Mississippi Headwaters Board, and Commissioner Napstead also serves on the board of Bowser. He's going to give some brief testimony and talk about the importance of this program to northern Minnesota and the upper Mississippi. So I'm going to let him carry on here and introduce the rest of the people at the table.
Commissioner Napstead, welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself for our records.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Brian Napstead. As Senator Saxhaw alluded to, I'm an Aiken County Commissioner, and I'm the 2009 chair of the Mississippi Headwaters Board. Today I've brought with me Bill Patnaud. He's the Environmental Services Director of Beltrami County. I also have Pam Kichler. She is our part-time administrative assistant on the Mississippi Headwaters Board. And I have one other Mississippi Headwaters Board member, Jack Frost, who is a Beltrami County Commissioner, in the audience. Today, what we would like to do, if it serves your pleasure, is we'd like to give a very brief presentation. We have a PowerPoint presentation prepared. It was originally a little longer, but we're going to make it brief. What we'd like to do is walk through the geography of the Mississippi Headwaters area. We'd like to do a very brief history on the formation of the Headwaters Board through Minnesota statute. And then we'd like to go on and just talk a little bit about the appropriations that we've received in the past. So if that serves the members, we'll move forward.
Mr. Napstead, it does, so go ahead with your presentation.
Thank you very much. First of all, the Mississippi, as we all know, flows from central Minnesota, Itasca, Lake Itasca in Clearwater County, down to the Gulf of Mexico. There are a number of management organizations involved in the entirety of the Mississippi. The question we're here to discuss is, who protects the first 400 miles of the Mississippi River? The Mississippi River, first 400 miles, flow through the counties that are shown on the map. Again, that's from Lake Itasca and Little Falls, from Lake Itasca down to Little Falls. There's an 8-county joint powers board that manages that area. Those counties include Clearwater County, Hubbard, Beltrami, Cass, Itasca, Aiken, Crow Wing, and Morrison counties. These 8 counties and the joint powers organization are called the Mississippi Headwaters Board. That board was created out of Minnesota statute, and Bill Patnaud has had the good fortune of being involved with the Mississippi Headwaters Board since its inception, since its legislative inception. So I'd like to have Bill make a few comments regarding the original formation of the board.
Mr. Patnaud, welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for our records.
My name is Bill Patnaud. I'm the Beltrami County Environmental Services Director, Mr. Chairman. I'm also the Technical Advisory Committee Chairman for the Mississippi Headwaters Board. I'm not going to read this in verbatim in regards to legislative history because you can see it up on the screen, but I think the key here is that the federal government looked at the upper 400 miles of the Mississippi River and was very considering the inclusion of the upper 400 miles of the Mississippi River in the Federal Wild and Scenic Rivers Program, and that came through President Ford's administration. The federal agencies were directed to put together a plan, which they did, and I think the catalyst of what happened in Minnesota was with Senator Lessard and his experience of what was happening with the U.S. Park Service and up in the Voyageurs National Park in International Falls, Minnesota. Senator Lessard came forward and asked for a meeting of all of the area counties in the upper 400 miles, and that was the eight counties that Brian talked about, and explained to them what was some of the dilemmas that the local populace as well as the local governmental units were facing with the Voyageurs National Park issue. With that, it was decided that the eight counties would come together, hire a consultant, and to pursue putting together a program for local control. And that was the most major emphasis that was placed on this, was local control and not federal control. With that, what took place in 1978 and 1979, the eight counties hired a consultant, put together a management plan. They also put together a land use control ordinance for the upper 400 miles of the river. I was also instrumental in that in working with the consultant with the other seven county zoning administrators at that time. What took place after that is the counties then individually adopted the management plan and the zoning ordinance. And I'm proud to say that Beltrami County was the second county. We did it December 2nd of 1980. And after that period of time, then what took place was the actual legislation, which created the Mississippi Headwaters Board. That is Minnesota Statute 103F361-377, Mr. Chairman. And then if you look on the screen, you can also see the mission statement that was adopted by the Mississippi Headwaters Board with the inclusion. Along with that adoption of the Mississippi Headwaters Program, the Mississippi Headwaters Board partnered with Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe and other local controls in the endeavor of protecting the Mississippi River. We also looked at other partnerships which were formed and also looking at to protect the upper 400 miles of the Mississippi River and to recognize that that is a very precious resource that needs to be protected. Many area programs were developed that involved the local community. Our River Watch program, our extension plantings, our science fairs, our youth congress, our canoe trips. And I might add that Senator Lessard was very adamant about that, of getting the area and the non-area legislators up there in northern Minnesota to go on canoe trips to actually see the river and what was being done. Also in the earlier years, the state supported specially funded grants and aids to the Mississippi Headwaters Board for the Economic and Environmental Trends Study, which was conducted by Bemidji State University in Bemidji, Minnesota. Go Beavers. The thing about that was looking at the economics in regards to water quality. That was done by Dr. Charlie Parsons and also by Professor Dr. Pat Welly. We also looked at the Mississippi Plan publication. The DNR assisted on that. The oral history of the river, which was a very important project that we did, and the River Watch program, which really looks at water quality issues on the river.
Mr. Chair and members, in 1999, the Mississippi Headwaters Board was funded at $170,000 per year during the biennium. The Mississippi River, of course, is the first 400 miles we protect, but there's also about 500 miles of shoreline on Headwaters Lakes that are under the protection of the Headwaters Ordinance as well, those being Bemidji, Cass, Winnebagoche, Leech, Big Sandy, Cross Lake, Whitefish Chain, Gull Lake. There's many, many miles of protection offered through the Mississippi Headwaters Ordinance. If you take a look at even our 1999 funding levels of $170,000, that comes down to about $184 per mile of shoreline in the cost to protect this resource. And we are talking about protection here, not restoration. We have a resource up there that is still in near pristine condition, and it's our intention to keep it that way. And I think we all know the bargain of protection versus restoration. The chart that you're looking at on the screen and perhaps before you shows the funding levels that we've experienced over the last decade or so. While we receive funding from counties, the state grants is basically the largest grant. We do receive some private grants. The pink bar chart shows the level of funding that we had in the 1999 time frame versus the funding level that we are presently at today. The organization has experienced consistent funding cuts over the years, and it is definitely hampering our ability to do our mission. Now, there is an in-kind report that the county submits to the DNR as well. The counties have kept up their in-kind payments even through this funding dearth that we found over the last few years. If you'll notice from the chart in your handouts, the county in-kind payments still exceed $600,000 a year, and that is primarily through zoning offices like Bill's organization enforcing the Headwaters Ordinance, our highway departments, our TEP panels. We're all following the ordinance when it comes down to protecting that corridor. Why is the Mississippi Headwaters Board important? Well, as Bill alluded to, it maintains responsibility for that headwaters protection to local government. I think it's very important to allow local governments the flexibility of protecting that resource while not restricting the resource entirely, which I believe more of a federal-oriented program would do. The Headwaters Board helps expose our future generations to the importance of environmentalism along the river, assists in preservation, as we've talked about already, and very importantly, a very important point down in the cities, is that we do provide a clean drinking water source to the cities. We have, when water leaves Little Falls, it is still in good order, and it can do nothing but good to the water supply down in the Twin Cities. What will it take to accomplish the task, and how will the funds be used? Well, we would like to see a restoration of state funds to the level that we had previously experienced, although, as Senator Saxhog has pointed out, we're in a difficult time frame. But more importantly, how will those funds be used? We think outcome is important. Outcome is the key measure of what's important with funds. We will continue to do needs assessments developed. We've done that for a long time. We simply have been hampered in the ability to do projects with our current state of funding. We would like to reignite the various programs that Bill talked about in his presentation, the River Watch being just one of them. We'd like to partner and support other organizations. We have had organizations and individuals come to us looking at on-site, on-the-ground restoration projects on their own property. We do not have the ability to cost share and do restoration type projects that would perhaps riprap a shoreline or stabilize a bank that an actual landowner wants to do on his property at most of their expense. If we could cost share with them, we could do more on-ground projects and produce a better outcome. In conclusion, we understand what's been going on with the state. We all represent counties and we're in the same boat, so you know it's no secret. But we do need to protect this organization. We think it's very important that we continue our partnership with the state of Minnesota and the 8-County Joint Powers Board, continue to work together to protect this resource for a very good bargain, I guess you could say. I guess we would like to ask you to consider the consequences if we don't. This is a joint powers organization that was put in place to keep the federal government at bay, as was referenced by Bill. Senator Lessard wanted to keep this control locally, and if this joint powers organization does not have adequate funding, the question is, what then?
Mr. Napstead, I well remember the Mississippi Headwaters Board, and I believe it was Senator Lessard who kept talking about it a fair amount. And I think we all realize that it's very important. I have a couple questions about your budget. What is the budget of the board, and what percent of it comes from the state appropriation, and what is from the counties themselves?
The state appropriation was at $65,000. The $170,000 that I referenced earlier was back at the beginning of at the end of the 90s, a decade ago. Up to last year, our budget from the state was $65,000 a year. That was cut down to $27,000 a year in legislation last year. The counties have direct payments of $13,500. The counties kick in, and that is excluding the in-kind payments that our zoning offices and so forth contribute through adherence to the ordinance. So our budget right now is for the 2009 year is $27,000 plus $13,000, and any grants we may receive from Minnesota Power, the Blandon Foundation, those that we have received in the past have been minimal, so it's probably right in the neighborhood of $50,000.
So, Mr. Napstead, the $13,000 you referenced, that is the total contribution of the counties, not from each county?
Total contribution from all of the counties. It's $1,500 per county, and the fiscal agent is Cass County. That used to be relieved, but I think Cass County is now providing that as well.
So, Mr. Knapstead, then, the board does not implement many programs, if any, itself. The counties do the implementation or the delivering of actual programs, and the board does coordination and recommendations and bringing people together to coordinate the efforts on the river?
Mr. Chair and members, I will comment on, I've been a county commissioner since 2005, hence a Mississippi Headwaters board member since that time frame. During that time frame, we have been in the limited budget time frame. I would like to defer to Bill to talk about how these programs were implemented in a time of full funding.
Mr. Patnod?
Mr. Chairman, in response to that question, the way that the programs were administrated was through the Mississippi Headwaters Board. The Mississippi Headwaters Board had staff at the time, and staff was the one that was coordinating, for example, the River Watch program came up through the results of the grant program from the Blandon Foundation. Those monies were able to provide the funds, which enabled the Mississippi Headwaters Board to hire a River Watch coordinator, but that wasn't a county position, Mr. Chairman.
So, and to either of you now, does the board have a staff itself now, or do you rely on counties for that?
Mr. Chair, committee members, the board staff consists of our part-time administrator, Pam Kitchler, who works out of the Cass County office in Bacchus, Minnesota, and Pam, 20 hours?
30
hours a week.
Okay, thank you. Further questions? Senator Anderson.
Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Excuse me. I'm looking in your report. Last year we required the board to hold some public hearings and take some testimony, and I'm just looking at the back. I think at the very back of the book you talk about some of the comments. Maybe you could give us some information about what the results of that were. I'm not sure if you mentioned that in your
Mr. Chair, committee members, the legislation that came out of last year's session required us to hold two public hearings to gather public input regarding the performance of the Headwaters Board. The two public hearings were scheduled, one at the Crow Wing County Courthouse in Brainerd, and the other at the Beltrami County Courthouse in Bemidji. I personally attended the session at the Crow Wing County Courthouse along with Senator Saxhog, Representative Ward, and I believe at that particular meeting we only had a couple of attendees show up to provide comment, and the comment that I recall offhand, which I think is elaborated in the, pardon me?
Eight attendees.
Okay, eight attendees for the Brainerd session, 12 for the Bemidji session. The comments that I recall, and I guess I'll look for help from Bill or whoever remembers, is a gentleman and his son referenced the fact that they enjoy canoeing the upper headwaters. It's clean, and they had showed up at the meeting to ask us to keep it that way. They enjoy clean water and a good fishery. And Senator Saxhog, I think you may even recall that particular individual.
And Mr.
Senator
Chair,
Anderson.
So it looks like there weren't a lot of people, so you can pretty much have all the responses in here.
That is correct.
Yeah. Okay. And Mr. Chair, sir, you talked a couple times about how this board is important to kind of keep the federal government at bay. I think you used that phrase. So what would the federal government do differently, do you think, if they were to manage this area?
Mr. Knapstead?
I will surmise from the comments that I've heard from Senator Lessard, who was interested in making sure that local control was maintained, perhaps a different way of saying the same thing. I believe Senator Lessard was speaking from his experience in Voyageurs National Park, where it went to primitive. Basically, it went to no local control, no development, and I believe it was his intention at that time to continue to allow responsible development. That was the outgrowth of the Headwaters Ordinance, which requires, among other things, for example, minimum lot sizes of 5 acres, 200-foot setbacks, no new trails in the wild corridor, conditional use permits required in the scenic corridor. It still allows for some level of use, but not wide open use nor back to primitive. And if that answers your question.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one more question, and this is
Senator Anderson.
I don't remember if you were here last year and we talked about the same thing. I can't recall, but I was lucky enough to do one of these canoe trips. Senator Mary Olson invited myself and some other senators up to canoe there, the Headwaters, a couple of springs ago. Senator Chaudhry was there, Senator Pappas, and I won't tell you which one tipped my canoe, but but we did see one concern that we heard from some local citizens was about some ATV use right along the Headwaters. And I don't recall exactly where this was. I can't tell you which landing it was at or what the ownership of the land is there, but we did witness some damage that had been done right next to the water, you know, right up the hill from the water. And is what's happening in that regard, and is the board involved in those discussions at all?
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Napstead,
committee members, the landing you're referencing is Coffee Pot Landing.
Yes, that's right.
The Minnesota legislature charged the DNR to inventory all of the ATV trails, the motorized trails, and I believe the non-motorized trails in all of the state parks under a certain time frame. The Mississippi Headwaters Park, the area in reference, was inventoried by the DNR, I believe it was last year. The DNR came to the Mississippi Headwaters Board to give us a preview of their plan. Recall that our jurisdiction is either a 1,000 or 500-foot corridor, depending upon whether you're in the wild or scenic area. The DNR came to the Mississippi Headwaters Board to elaborate their plan for the Mississippi Headwaters Forest, and that was to only allow motorized trails where they were environmentally supportable. And, in fact, the DNR proposed removing quite a few miles of trails out of the Mississippi Headwaters Forest, although not all of the trails from the Mississippi Headwaters Forest. And those trails that they elected to keep were outside of the corridor, therefore outside of our jurisdiction. However, there is a landing or a crossing of the river at Coffee Pot Landing. Now, I think Bill can speak to this exact situation better than I can. My understanding is that the DNR has gone in and upgraded that crossing, and perhaps I can allow Bill to, because he's in Beltrami County where that crossing is, maybe give the final explanation.
Coffee Pot's in Hubbard.
Oh, Coffee Pot, okay.
The Mr. Coffee Pat Pot Bond. Landing that, Mr. Chairman, the Coffee Pot Landing that is being spoken about is in Hubbard County, not Beltrami County. We had an opportunity to go on a field tour of that area and to see what the DNR and also Hubbard County has been doing in regards to the issue that you raised about the ETVs. I also want to – was done in September. Little voice in my ear here. Good coach. Also, Beltrami County has had some areas, too, that have experienced some ATV damage. And I want to let the chairman know and the committee members know that Beltrami County has taken action on those. And we went out and we did a field review of that with Senator Olson. We showed her those areas. In fact, I took 142 photos, and I'll be more than happy to share those photos with any of you committee members. So it is an issue. We are addressing it. I want to tell you, though, that the DNR has been very cooperative in identifying those areas that are very sensitive in the river corridor, especially in the Mississippi Headwaters Forest area, and they have been closing those areas.
Okay, thank you. And
Mr. Chair, committee members, the most recent revision, we are required by law to update the Headwaters Ordinance every 5 years. The most recent revision prohibits ATV trails in the wild section of the headwaters.
Okay, thank you. Senator Vickerman?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm not going to worry too much about those four-wheelers. My idea is those two girls there, and I have a cabin very close to that. I walk through the woods to Grandma's house, I could get there. And all my kids and grandkids, even I have, this old man is walking that river where the headwater. It's just something to see. Go there on any day and see how many thousands of people show up there. Great thing. You need to keep it. And I'd like to help you find the money, but I don't know if we can do it in some way. We'll find the money, Senator Sexhog. I think we have to. That's a jewel that we can't pass up.
You're replaceable.
Those two girls. Look how much fun they're having.
I think the committee has a pretty good understanding of the issue and what you'd like to do. I'm going to ask if there's anybody else in the audience that would like to testify for or against Senate File 1677. I don't see anybody coming to the table. Senator Sachsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would then move that Senate File 1677 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Members, on Senator Saxhog's motion that Senate File 1677 be laid over for possible inclusion in the bill, all those in favor indicate by saying aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you very much for coming and talking with us about the Mississippi Headwaters Board.
Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you for your time.
Which one do you want to
Is
right over there.
Yep.
Senator Olsen? Committee has before it now Senate File 383, Yard Waste and Plastic Bags Prohibition. Senator Olsen, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you for having me. Here's my bag. These are what we're looking at is in the metropolitan area that people would be required to use. These are a biodegradable, compostable bag that... You know, you fill your yard waste up, and it goes to a compost facility, and the bag virtually disappears. So what's driving this bill, members, is that plastic bags, when they go to a composting site, many times the material is cut out and dumped, and plastic gets mixed in. And so when the yard waste turns into compost, it's not really good material, sellable material, because it has a lot of plastic remnants mixed in. And so by going to this would address that problem. This turns into nothing in a short time. And I have, from CoreTech, I have Mr. Warren, who these guys are experts on the chemical makeup of this stuff. And but I guess the reason we're here is because there's a fiscal note to this. And there would be some oversight by the Pollution Control Agency to make sure that metro area stores comply with the requirement that these compostable bags are sold and that they are truly compostable bags that meet the standards that are laid out in the law. So having said that, I do have an amendment that kind of needs to bring it into the line here.
Madam Chair, I would like to move that amendment. I don't have it in front of, we don't have it in front of us, I don't think, yet.
Okay, the amendment's being passed out. Thank you.
Madam Chair, should I speak to the amendment?
Please do, while it's going.
Okay. We have the A5 amendment, which is come forth because of negotiations with the City of Minneapolis being in the metropolitan area. They are moving towards a cart system where hopefully by 2013, residents of Minneapolis would put their yard waste in a cart and just push it out to the curb, and then a separate truck would pick that up, and so they wouldn't need the bags. And the feeling was that for them to switch to these compostable bags and then in a couple of years switch to the carts, it would just be kind of a couple of extra steps that would cause a lot more grief probably than anything. And they do have a system now where they hire people. The bags go to a yard, and the plastic bags are ripped up and taken out, and so they're already kind of handling that now. So this amendment addresses that by the year or by January 1, 2013, they would, if hopefully they've gone to this cart system by then. Otherwise, I guess they'd have to go to the bag system. Then there's some other cleanup language throughout the bill.
All right, Senator Olstein. So this is the this amendment you said is worked out with the city of Minneapolis?
That is correct.
And then it still applies to other cities of the first class, I think? No.
Yeah. And
no, you took, wait.
It's just Minneapolis that's talking about this CART system.
Right, and it looks like you deleted the language about a city of the first class anyway. So
I believe so.
It would just be apply equally statewide to everyone else.
Madam Chair, no, this is only in the metropolitan area.
I see. Got it. Thank you. Any other questions on the A5 amendment? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Senator Olstein.
Madam Chair, would you like some expert witness on the bill? Or?
Well, maybe very, very brief, because we really just want to focus on the fiscal impact to the state agencies.
Madam Chair, committee, my name is Michael Morin. I'm with Cortec Corporation. We're a manufacturer of the plastic, the biodegradable plastic bags. We have an extrusion plant right in Cambridge, Minnesota, where the bags are made. We support this bill because we feel that with the erroneous information that's out there of that Senator Olstein touched on, was that retailers are getting bags that are saying they're biodegradable, but they're not. So putting that out there, saying if they meet the standard of the ASTM 6400, they meet that standard, then people know, the consumers of Minnesota know, that they're getting a true biodegradable compostable bag that breaks down into carbon dioxide and water within a matter of weeks, depending on how well the compost facility is maintained. So within that, I mean, there are four manufacturers right here in Minnesota, so we feel that it helps support that, and it generates competition between us to know that, okay, we still have it. We're making it available to everybody. They don't have to buy just from one source, that it's there for everybody else to cost. And the cost of the bags are, I mean, they're pennies. I mean, they're 13 cents a bag versus a dollar for a paper bag that you can use today versus debagging the products that compost facilities have to go through. So we, as a corporation in Minnesota, we support this bill. Hope that you take that into advisement.
Thank you very much. Can you tell us what these are made out of, or is that
they're
a
made out
trade
of,
secret?
It's made out of polyester.
Oh.
So it's our bags are made from polyester. There are bags that are made from PLA, which is polylactic acid. It's a derivative of corn. There's some other bioplastics that are in there. So you look at it, and so polyester, you say, okay, it's petroleum-based. It still breaks down into carbon dioxide and water with no harmful effects to the environment at all. Same microorganisms that eat your grass clippings and leaves eat the bags.
Madam Chair, there's something about a long molecule, and I don't know what the heck.
And it doesn't emit carbon dioxide gas into the atmosphere?
No.
Okay. Very good. All right. Well, Senator Olstein, because and you did go to the Judiciary Committee, I assume, with all this other language in here. You've been everywhere. Third engrossment. You've been around the Capitol. Because the fiscal note does call for a cost to the PCA, we keep bills like this in our budget bill. So I would propose that if someone would be willing to move to lay it on the table, that's what we ought to do.
Like
I think
it.
She beat you to it, Senator okay, Fredrickson. Let me ask if anyone else would like to testify on Senate File 383. Hearing no further discussion, Senator Torres Ray moves that Senate File 383 as amended be laid on the table for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. On that motion, any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members, thank you.
Okay, I think Senator Sieben is here, so we'll take her, unless Senator Rest is walking in the door. Well, that's okay if she's somewhere else. We'll just take Senator Sieben. She's been waiting quite a while.
It shouldn't happen.
Okay. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Senate File 1955 would establish a competitive grant program for composting in the state of Minnesota. And, Madam Chair, I would ask that someone would please move the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape I would prefer. This is the first stop for the bill.
This is the first hearing for this bill?
Yes, ma'am.
I'd like to move the amendment, Madam Chair.
I'm sorry, did somebody?
I move the amendment.
Okay, Senator Torres Ray moves. the A1 author's amendment. On that motion, all in favor, well, wait till it's passed out.
Madam Chair and committee members, I can explain the amendment.
Why don't
as,
you, please?
As we go through it,
okay.
As I go through the bill, these are changes that the House did make, so it's conforming to the House language. But
Senator Sieben, we don't usually see that as a persuasive argument to do something. I hope there's a better reason than that.
As a former House member, I always
hopefully you can
swear. Point out that we do work together.
Maybe you could pull your microphone a little closer, please.
Sure.
Yeah. So, all right. Let's. Has everyone seen the A1 amendment? It's as an author's amendment. It's been offered. Uh-huh. Senator Fredrickson.
I was looking at lines 2 and 3, page 1. It says first delete the subdivision, and it looks like in line 3 we would be making a change to the subdivision. We delete it. Right?
Page 1, delete subdivision.
There's no subdivision.
Where's subdivision 1?
There's a section 1.
Same bill? No.
Are you looking at the right bill? It's a different.
Are you looking at Senator Rest's bill, which is what I was just doing? Yeah, sorry, we just switched order, and so.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, no, that's okay. I just did the same thing. All right, yeah, we're on 1955. So
definition is being.
This is being authored as an author's amendment. Let's adopt the amendment and then let Senator Sieben explain it. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. Motion prevails. Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Fredrickson pointed out, the first subdivision would be deleted, and so then in the subdivision 2 through 4 in the actual bill itself, the legislation says that political subdivisions in the state are eligible for the grant programs, that applications must be submitted to the Commissioner of the PCA. And that grants shall be awarded to projects that have the highest public benefit. And then on the second page of the bill, it says that to be eligible for a grant, a project must be locally administered, have measurable outcomes, and then include at least one of the following elements, either the development of erosion control methods that use compost, activities to encourage on-site composting by homeowners, or activities to encourage composting by schools or public institutions. And that language is in the amendment. And then Section 2 of the bill just says that a report must be given to the policy committee here in the legislature. And Section 3 appropriates $1 million from the Environmental Fund to the PCA and is available for spending through fiscal year 2011. And perhaps now we could hear from testifiers mm-hmm. of the bill. First, Amy Carolyn is from Washington County Conservation District.
All right, welcome to the committee, Ms. Carolyn.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. I am a natural resources specialist with the Washington County Conservation District. Just wanted to speak with you briefly today.
Ms. Carolyn, please identify yourself for the record, if you would. Just say your name.
Amy Carlin.
Thank you.
The Washington County Conservation District, like other conservation districts in the state of Minnesota, is unique because we have the opportunity to directly work with residents and communities within our counties. And we work to promote environmental protection. We do this through a variety of different grant opportunities and different projects that we can work with. Currently, we have the capacity to both technically and financially assist many communities and residents with different programs such as tree plantings, cropland conservation, and water quality improvement projects. At this time, we actually work to promote individual composting systems, but we do not have a system in place really where we could actually offer complete technical assistance and financial assistance to any residents that might come through our doors. We do get several inquiries from residents on a weekly basis, likely 5 to 6 inquiries a week, wondering if we do have any type of grant money available that could help them with setting up their own individual composting system, or communities that are looking to do more of a community-type composting system. So therefore, I guess moving this bill forward or passing this bill forward would really give us the opportunity to expand the current programs that we have and offer more assistance to residents and communities to set up this composting type system. And it would also provide us with some financial assistance to set up a more complete program that we could offer educational components to residents and communities on how to set up their own composting systems, and also allow us to maybe come by all the tools necessary that residents may need, or just additional technical support. So thank you. I'd take any questions as well.
Thank you, Ms. Carolyn. So you would envision applying for how much money, and then how would you divide that up among grantees?
Typically, when we apply for technical assistance or financial assistance in the amount of about $75,000 to $90,000, and we use that on that would be on an annual basis, I suppose. And we typically offer cost share programs, so we would pay for 50% to 75% of a person's startup cost to just get going. And this would be probably on a resident by resident basis, so it would be working directly with landowners.
So how much does it cost for an individual? I mean, you're going to, the cost share, you're like for a compost bin or something? I mean,
likely it would be for materials that they would need to get started. I would say maybe between $250 to $500 to maybe $1,000 just for residents to get started. Likely not on the far end. It would be lower, $250 to $500, which is typical for many of our projects. Say if someone was building a rainwater garden or doing a shoreline restoration projects, often our projects are somewhere between $250 to $500 to help a person get started.
Senator Sieben.
Madam Chair, in speaking with other advocates of this bill, they also envisioned perhaps a school district or a county or a city would purchase composting bins, and then through this grant program make them available to homeowners at a reduced rate. So perhaps instead of paying $50 for a composting bin, they could purchase it for $25 or $37. But as you'll see in the legislation, these grant applications would need to go through a competitive process at the PCA, where it would be up to the commissioner's discretion to award the grants to the local political units based on the what that entity had put forward in their application.
So you're envisioning, well, I guess let's hear your other testifier first, and then we can ask those questions.
Madam Chair, Gary Noren from Chisago County is here to provide testimony as well.
Welcome to the committee.
Hi, I'm Gary Noren, Chisago County Environmental Services, former solid waste administrator, and now working on a grant from the U.S. Department of Agriculture on waste reduction in the schools of Chisago County. Madam Chair and committee members, I'm happy to tell you about the project I've been working on for the last year and a half. But just in opening, I'll just say as the solid waste administrator for the county, I did see a growing need for more resources for composting for homeowners. This project, again, now is just about the schools. And I had a lot of fun with this project. And one of the things that we started out the second year with was something called the Conserving Classroom. And I brought copies of, maybe you want to take some pass around. The month of May has learned to compost on it. And you'll see in the middle here the different activities that are set aside for the kids to do. The idea for the Conserving Classroom was if the teacher agrees to be a Conserving Classroom, then this calendar is something that they look at on a day-by-day basis, and there are special days set aside for Rachel Carson's birthday and other things like this. But for the month of May, I thought it would be really appropriate for you to see what we're doing with that. I have a PowerPoint presentation for you, but I won't show you. I'll just tell you that this is a very successful program in the county. We have had superintendents, school boards, maintenance people, and food service people, along with National Honor Society students, all supporting this idea of separating out food waste. Now, the end product for Chisago County has been feeding pigs, but if there were resources available for composting, I'm sure that would be a nice option also. One of the things that I was mentioning earlier is that I think the EPA estimate is about 24% of the municipal solid waste in the United States is compostable, either food waste or yard waste. So we're talking about a large amount of stuff that could be diverted from landfilling and incineration. I'll take questions.
All right, thank you. Did you make these calendars? Your
well,
county?
I did, but I have to give a lot of credit to the Pollution Control Agency. Oh. They worked hand in hand with me. You might recognize a lot of those graphics came from them.
Okay.
And I'll also mention that just today I heard that I've got a funder that's willing to give us $5,000 to continue doing this in our part of the state.
Very nice. I know in my children's school in St. Paul, they already separate all their food waste in the cafeteria, and I think it goes to
schools.
Some pigs,
yep,
but I don't
yep.
know where. So, also, and I have to say, you know, I've been teaching my kids about composting, and they're so good at it. Well, they forget to do it in the house, but they love to go outside and throw things in the garden. Oh, throw the watermelon rinds, and okay, well.
Oh, not the watermelon.
Yeah, there's got to be a little tomatoes. Bit careful how much they throw along the side of my yard by the neighbor's house. Thank you very much for your testimony. Senator Sieben, how did you come up with the $1 million? I mean, how would you envision it sort of being divided up around the state?
Madam Chair, this bill actually came to me from a House member, but what she told me is that the PCA has done grants for composting in the past out of the Environmental Fund, but that some of this money, this is just making it more explicit that this money would be available for some of these composting grants. I don't know if $1 million from the PCA was used before for composting, but that's about as much as I can tell you is that
okay.
was how it came over to me from the House.
Okay. And so this could go to county, school district, cities, any
political subdivision.
Parks, okay.
Right,
sure.
Correct. And I should also point out that the House author told me that in some parts of rural Minnesota, erosion control practices, you'll see on the original bill on line 2.10, developing erosion control practices that use compost. They envision that some counties would be willing to apply for these grants. So instead of using large rocks for erosion control programs, that compost could actually be used in ditches so that organic materials could grow there and help with erosion control problems instead of using large rocks. It's larger than gravel, I guess, that's sometimes used that has... that can cause problems for cars that are driving and go into the ditch, for instance. So that's one other point that may be of interest.
Senator Dill?
Madam Chair, Senator Sieben, I don't know if I quite follow all that.
I don't think I explained it very well.
You're going to put compost in there, and is your thought that's going to help make the grass grow better to help control erosion or what?
I think you have it right, but Ms. Carolyn.
Ms. Carolyn.
Oftentimes during maybe a road reconstruction project or something like that, you can have compaction issues, and mixing in compost makes the soil much more organic, and your likelihood of having vegetation established in those areas is much increased. So I could see compost as a use for erosion control if you have a larger amount of compost.
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Dill.
And Ms. Carolyn,
What about the rocks?
Currently, it's like the Mississippi, the ones before us talking about rock riprap to stabilize areas that are highly erodible. Rocks are currently used, whereas compost used as a soil amendment to allow vegetation to grow in that area could be used as a replacement to rock riprap in those areas. But you'd need vegetative material established along with the compost, but the compost would enable that to occur.
Probably cheaper than rocks, than buying big rocks. Dump trucks full of rocks. Senator Torres, ready?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Seaton, I have a question about the amendment. I don't know if you want to include this language. In the amendment, you have in line 1-8, to insert each grant must include an educational component. And later in the bill, in page 2, you have priorities, and you incorporate education programs as priority. I assume that if you incorporate this language of the amendment into the bill, it would be interpreted, and staff may advise us on this, as one of the priorities for grant establishment, meaning that, you know, your purpose in this legislation, as I read the language, says to increase composting and reduce the amount of organic waste. That's what you want to do. This language says now that you also should include educational component, which really expands the scope of what you want to do, which is, I don't think there's anything wrong with that, but it's significant because of the place, the language is placed in a very, in the establishment. And then later on you put priorities. My sense is that you don't need the amendment that was put in the House for it, including, plus this is very broad language, which means that I think it needs to be further developed if you really want to establish it as criteria, because now you're expanding the scope of your legislation and incorporating some language that says you must establish an educational component, and I don't think that is defined here. So I'm wondering, I think it needs to be better defined if you want that language in there. But my suggestion would be that it will be taken, that it should be taken out. But
Senator Torres, right?
Senator Seaton.
Madam Chair, the language on the amendment that says it must include an educational component was put in the legislation in the House because the idea was that if these grants are going to be given out, even if they're to non-schools, for instance, to counties or cities, that there should be some component of the grant which helps to educate the general population about the benefits of composting. So it could be that the county is making available composting bins at a reduced rate, and the material that goes along with it that could be in the county newsletter saying that the bins are available could say that it could be as simple as saying that, you know, if you can compost your waste up to 24% of waste right now could be composted or used as yard waste. So the idea there was not that it would, that this would need to be used to educate children per se, but more in a broader definition that the grants that are given out should be used in a way where the PCA commissioner is ensuring that the grants help advocate the benefits of composting.
Senator Torres, right?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess that would be the intention here, but I just think that this language is so broad. It could be interpreted in a different way, too. So
Senator Torres, right, what is your concern, that it only applies to schools?
No. Madam Chair, it's just that the language, the amendment now says that it's asking to insert language in page 1, which is subdivision 2, which is the grant establishment. The scope of this bill is really about increasing composting and reducing the amount of organic waste. The House is introduced a language that says that each grant must include an educational component.
I see that.
But it's so broad, the language is so broad right now.
Senator Torres-Ray, I guess I don't see a problem with it. I'm trying to understand what your objection to that language is. It seems to me that if you want to change people's behavior and encourage them to compost, you need to educate them about why it's important, why it, you know, is good for the environment, whatever it is, or how to do it. I mean, I think that's how I read it, as an educational component. Maybe you're reading something else into it that I don't see.
Madam Chair.
Senator Sieben.
I wonder if on the amendment, if we added language that, so it would read, each grant must include an educational component that educates recipients on the benefits of composting.
I don't think you have to say educational twice.
Right. But, right. Yeah. Well,
would that help, Senator Torres-Ray?
Yes, Madam Chair. I think that I'm looking for something that connects this educational component to the actual intent of the legislation, because right now it's just kind of,
okay,
it must, you know,
would you like
it's
to move
not
that?
Connected.
Would you like to move that language?
Yeah, I think
let's
that
say.
Would be.
What if we just said that include an educational component on the benefits of composting?
Sounds good. Okay. Senator Torres-Ray, do you want to make that motion?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'll move that.
Senator
Dill? Well,
Madam Chair, in addition to teaching people about the benefits of composting, we should also teach them how to do it.
Yes, that is true. That's the other piece of it. Right. The benefits and practices of composting, or I don't know.
Methods.
Anybody have any better ideas?
Methods.
That's better than practices. Benefits and methods of composting. How's that? Senator Torres-Ray, would you like to incorporate that language into your motion?
Yes, Madam Chair. I move that we incorporate that new language into the amendment.
Does our staff have the exact language? Okay. All right. On the motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Great. Is there any further discussion? Would anyone else like to be heard on Senate File 1955? Would someone like to move the bill for possible inclusion? Senator Saxhog moves that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that Senate File 1955 is amended be set aside or laid on the table for possible inclusion
in the
omnibus bill.
All right. On that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Rest.
Early child.
This is a private one.
Yeah.
They pretty much all are. My kids used to work out.
This one's called especially for
welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Senate File 1600 is a proposal that is responding to a need that we have in Minnesota to make our technology accessible. Currently, we do not have any set standards for doing so, and what the bill does is three things. One, it ask for those standards to be set according to the federal guidelines. It also sets up the responsible parties in the state agencies, namely OET and Department of Administration, to be in charge of making sure that the standards, where they're appropriate, are in place. And thirdly, it sets up a task force, an advisory group over the next 2 years to make recommendations to the departments and to the legislature with regard to these standards. There was concern in the bill about the ability to actually put these in place, and there's been a lot of work going on in the last few days, and I believe there is an amendment coming forward that represents the work of the special interests for representing people representing the blind, the deaf-blind, and the deaf, hard of hearing, represents the work that they've been doing with OET and the Department of Administration to ensure that there is no undue burden placed on the agencies and inappropriate undue burden, inappropriate burden, so that in order to have these standards, we would cost ourselves out of the possibility of enacting them. And I don't know if the amendment is...
We do have the delete all amendment is now being passed out.
Then, Madam Chair, I do not have a copy of it.
It's coming. And Senator Rest, can you explain it, or you need to wait till you have your copy first? As it's coming around, we'll just wait for your...
I have, Madam Chair, I know what's in the bill is just what I indicated to you, but Mr. Bodden is here from Senate Counsel, who drafted what was originally a page and line amendment to make this a delete all amendment so that for the committee's understanding, it you wouldn't have to go back and forth between unofficial engrossments. The bill has been to two other committees and this version in order to follow it. So if I could ask him to indicate where the what the delete all amendment is doing and the changes that it's made from the bill. But in a, but in essence, what it has done is to make sure that there are safeguards in terms of feasibility of costs and the division of responsibilities so that we don't have a bill that from the get-go costs a quarter of $1 billion. That is not the intent of this bill.
That's good.
Right. I thought
Butter,
you would think that would be an improvement.
Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, I can walk you quickly through the delete everything just to show you where the changes are. Again, I wasn't working from the division, the committee engrossment, but rather from the committee report and the original, the first engrossment of the bill. The first set of changes, and I think Senator Rest described this already, basically the rules that the original bill required are now standards, and they would be developed and required. So you'll see changes throughout. For example, on page 1, line 6 of the delete everything refers to accessibility standards that are developed under section 16E.03. Then the next change you'll see is on in section 2 of the delete everything. That requires application of these standards. It's basically a conforming amendment to refer to those standards. There is some, without referring back to the original bill, there's some old language that's taken out, but this accomplishes a substantially similar purpose. Then if you look on page 6 of the, I think that's where it is, on page 5, excuse me, of the delete everything, you'll see a new set of definitions. Those are all, the accessibility definition was there, but there are now definitions provided for undue burden and infrastructure hardware. Then the additional changes would be, can also be found on, let's see.
6.
If you look on the bottom of page 6, beginning on line 27, there's a new paragraph B that basically provides new direction on how the chief information officer would require the agencies to adhere to the standards, and again contains conforming amendments that would change how the standards are developed in a manner that's very similar to the way the rules would be adopted. Then there's a new paragraph C at the top of page 7 that clarifies how the chief information officer works with the advisory committee to provide some exceptions to the new standards if necessary, which and that's also included in section 11 on page 7. That's the formal allowance for the exceptions to the standards. Then there are a number of smaller page and line changes that are reflected in the new Section 12 for the Advisory Committee relating to how it works with the standards. In particular, you'll see on the top of page 8 there's a new Clause 2 where they recommend the exception process and thresholds for deviation from the accessibility standards. And that's really about it. I apologize for any confusion in putting that together.
Okay. Thank
Madam
you very
Chair,
much.
Section 15 is the funding mechanism for the for this proposal, which is why it, as I believe the your division has jurisdiction over these funds. It's why it is here. Otherwise, it's also already been heard, and some of the amendments were made in the state government finance.
Well, Senator Rest, I believe you're asking for all of these funds to come from the TAM account.
That's correct.
In the Commerce Department, and that's based on a phone charge and meant for accessibility purposes. So, but this would go beyond what existing law authorizes. So that's, I think,
that's
what we
why
need
the,
to
I think the language had the language specifies that.
So should we hear from your witnesses?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Ms. Hartnett, welcome to the committee.
And Madam Chair, thank you, and members of the committee. My name is Mary Hartnett, and I'm the Executive Director of the Commission of Deaf, Deafblind, and Hard of Hearing Minnesotans. I'd like to thank Senator Rest for introducing this legislation and being so supportive of it. I wanted to just, I'll speak specifically to the relevancy of, we believe, of the TAM fund to this bill and the funding of this bill, and then my colleague Jamie Taylor will get more into the specifics of the bill itself very briefly. As you know, the Telecommunications Access Minnesota Fund was created initially to respond to the ADA requirement that telecommunications be made accessible to people that are deaf and hard of hearing. Oh, speak louder, sorry. And a few years ago, that bill was amended to also include a new service for people that are blind, for them to be able to access that information through the phone, and also for new services for people that are deaf and hard of hearing. And those programs have been very successful, and those are also funded in other states. Those sorts of programs have been funded in other states, and actually South Carolina is funding their 508 and WCAG access programs through their telecommunications access funds. The captioning online is typically provided by captionists that are listening through the phone, and the 508 standards themselves also include telecommunications equipment. That's why we look to this fund for the two-year funding for the pilot services. The funding itself would pay for a coordinator who would coordinate these efforts within the Department of Office of Enterprise Technology, convene the advisory committee, and make the recommendations to the legislature for how to provide the best the best access at the most affordable cost. The second part of the funding is pilot funds for the legislature to caption online video and live streaming, which is currently provided but is not captioned. Many more hearings are being shown online, on the computer, live streamed, and people who are deaf and hard of hearing, over 10% of the state isn't able to access that information, and we'd like to pilot that. 19 other states have adopted these standards, and 6 others are providing online live streaming. And then the last would for the Commission of Deaf, Deafblind, and Hard of Hearing, to provide some of our content in American Sign Language. Many of the people that we represent don't read English above a third to second grade reading level, and others who are professionals whose first language is American Sign Language would like us to be able to provide some of that content in ASL. The standards that we've suggested and have been introduced into this legislation, the Web Content Access Guidelines have 3 levels, A, AA, AAA, and AAA is providing some of those some of the content in American Sign Language. So that's why we were looking toward the TAM fund for coverage for the two-year pilot that we have in the legislation or in the bill. And then I'd like my colleague Jamie Taylor to explain a little bit more about WCAG, the Web Content Access Guidelines, in Section 508.
All right. Thank you. Ms.
Okay.
Taylor?
I hope you can hear me. Can you hear
yes.
me? Okay. The reason why I asked that was because I am deafblind. I'm also Madam Chair and members of the committee. Jamie Taylor, not Mary Hartnett, like she said on the agenda. And I'm here to give a very brief explanation of 508 and WCAG, Web Content Accessibility Guidelines, like Mary had mentioned. 508 is a section of federal law that requires that federal employees and members of the public with disabilities have the same access to and use of information and data at the federal level that members of the public and federal employees without disabilities have, unless it would cause an undue burden financially. Web Content Accessibility Guidelines, however, were created by the World Wide Web Consortium, or the W3C, which is the main international standards organization for the World Wide Web. As Mary had mentioned, there are three levels of accessibility in the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines, A, AA, and AAA. We would like to pilot accessibility such as closed captioning, live closed captioning, streaming, live streaming closed captioning, which is at the AA and AAA levels, which are the higher levels of access in the WCAG. The advisory committee would then get together and write recommendations on how to provide the highest level of accessibility without providing an undue burden to the states. We have contacted the Commission of Deaf, Deafblind, and Hard of Hearing Minnesotans, I should say, have contacted 18 other states who have adopted standards such as what we propose in this bill. What is proposed in this bill. They have, in your packets, you'll find Oklahoma's response, and they said that there are no fiscal impacts for their advisory committee. Two, they know of no state agencies in Oklahoma that have hired full-time employees to implement their standards. Number three, that they actually had cost savings because they did not have to retrofit software that they had already purchased. So thank you for allowing me to testify very briefly on this bill.
Thank you very much. Just in summary, so this will provide communication services for all state functions, state information from all state agencies, including the legislature? I'm not quite clear on what the scope of this is.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this bill would have the state adopt 508 standards. Uh-huh. Right now, yes. Many of the websites, people who are blind, and actually Representative Tori Westrum testified in several committee hearings in the Senate and in the House, quite eloquently spoke about how he is unable to access much of the information that many that the legislators and representatives are able to access because they are sighted. As a person who is blind, he is unable to access that information. We do not have uniform accessibility standards that actually are for the most part very simple to adopt. They should be integrated into the standards that we have in the state in OET. And add these guidelines so people that have a screen reader, for example, can interface with websites online and make sure that they're able to access e-government services at the same level.
Okay.
And
Ms. Hartnett, let me just stop you for a minute, because the question was really specific, and I think you're getting to an answer, which is standards for what? And that's for the delivery of state government information only? This doesn't apply to the private sector. I mean, Madam
Chair, members of the committee, this would apply to state purchases through admin, and this would apply to state government websites. It would not apply to the private sector.
Okay. And so
to the legislature and to the Supreme Court, to all three branches of state government.
Okay. So, but not to any kind of local government either? Or maybe they could use those standards if they chose to?
Chair,
would this apply to them?
If a person in local government wanted to, who was deaf, blind, or hard of hearing, wanted to access the state's website, currently they would have a lot of difficulty in doing so. So in that regard, yes, but it's not a burden. It is not an obligation that local governments adopt these standards. It's only adopting technology standards for the
state.
Accessibility
government.
On the state
Thank
level.
You. I just wanted to be
yes,
clarified.
Just on the state
Thank you.
Level.
I understand. And so the money that you're asking for is to support this advisory group that will help to develop those standards?
The standards
really
are,
briefly.
Madam Chair, the standards are in section subdivision 9 that Ms. Hartnett has referenced, and they are standards that are set by the by federal legislation. What the advisory group would do would be to indicate how they could best be implemented.
Okay.
And make recommendations on their implementation, in particular to make sure that there is that feasibility in terms of low-cost alternatives that also meet the standards would be considered by OET and the administration. So there's a lot of covering language in terms of not imposing an undue burden, which is why the Chief Information Officer is permitted the authority to waive the standard if it would cost too much to implement. And there are definitions of what undue burden means so that doesn't happen.
Senator Rest, I'm really just trying to hone in on exactly where the money would go and for what purpose. And I think I'm getting it, but so the State Information Officer, this would fund their part of this whole process. But I guess
the money would go to the CIO, again, if you look at page 9, for coordinating technology accessibility and usability. Part of the money would go to the Commission of Deaf, Blind, and Hard of Hearing to provide information, and $100,000, part of it would go to the Legislative Coordinating Commission for a pilot program to provide live streaming. The money does not go directly to the advisory committee.
She cannot.
Rest can't.
So it's not to support the work of the advisory committee. They are doing this. They're all state employees is what it amounts to.
Okay. And then you're envisioning that this would be for 2 years, but that it
and
would
then
be,
cut off.
Mm-hmm. And then you wouldn't need, what would happen in the future?
The advisory committee would be making recommendations to the CIO, making recommendations to the legislature for implementation of the standards, which may require additional legislation. It may not. This is a time-limited study. We're not asking for it to go on indefinitely or for this to be an advisory committee that goes on indefinitely. There are some advisory committees that have a permanent status. This would not be one.
All right. Thank you. Ms. Wells from Commerce would like to testify. Members, I think it'd be better if we try to finish this bill now. And so let's keep going for just a few more minutes. And then I just want to remind members while Ms. Wells is coming up that we're recessing until 6:30 and come back to this room at 6:30. And we only have 4 more bills, I think, so hopefully it won't be a late night. Ms. Wells, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, and Senator Rest. My name is Diane Wells, and I'm the manager of the Telecommunications Division within the Department of Commerce. I was here a few weeks ago to go over our budget. Today, my purpose for being here is limited solely to Section 15 of the bill, which allocates $300,000 per year from the Telecommunications Access Minnesota Fund, which is administered by the Department of Commerce. The TAM Fund was established in 1987 for the purpose of providing access to the telecommunications network for people who are deaf, hard of hearing, speech disabled, or physically disabled. This is done by providing devices to enable the use of the telephone and or the relay service to facilitate conversations between communications impaired persons and those without an impairment. The TAM program is supported by a 6-cent per month surcharge assessed against every landline and wireless telephone in Minnesota, so it is funded by telephone ratepayers in the state of Minnesota, not by broadband ratepayers, not by internet ratepayers, but by telephone ratepayers. And in 87, I think it was determined to be fair to assess telephone ratepayers because the more people you can have on the network, the more valuable it is to those on the network. So, for example, if a communications impaired person can now subscribe to telephone service and I can call them, they can call me, that's more valuable to me as a telephone ratepayer and to them as a telephone ratepayer. The TAM program and budget is administered within the Department of Commerce. The TAM program would be the relay service, the equipment, and then the administration. The other programs that are funded by TAM are just direct transfers out of the fund. The Commerce has no oversight over those programs. So as the overseer of the TAM fund, we believe it is our responsibility to alert you when there are proposals, such as in Section 15 of Senate File 1600, that we believe would appropriate TAM funds for uses not intended when the program was established and that go astray of the intent of the TAM program, which, as I stated, is to facilitate use of the telephone by communications impaired persons. I would also like to add that, as you are probably aware, this bill was not a part of the governor's budget recommendation. Thank you for the opportunity to note our concern regarding the impact of Section 15 on the TAM fund, and I would be happy to try to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you very much, Ms. Wells. Tell us what's the state of the fund and whether your obligations that you already have are covered by the funds. What would this do to your ability to do your ongoing obligations under law?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Currently, the fee is 6 cents per month on every telephone, landline, and wireless. It would be 5 cents if we weren't funding the non-TAM programs today. Our projections are it will need to go to 7 cents a month next July because the balance is drawn down. And I know that doesn't sound like a lot of money, but I mean, I was just on the phone yesterday with an elderly widow who was going over her telephone bill with me line by line trying to figure out where every cent was going. So people do look at these amounts.
Okay, so you said that the non-TAM expenses are drawing down the fund. Can you remind us what those other expenses are?
Currently, we have $300,000 a year goes to the Minnesota Commission for Deaf, Deaf-Blind, and Hard of Hearing. Up to $200,000 in the fiscal year, so $100,000 a year, goes to the Accessible News, which is the closed captioning on the outstate television stations. No, I'm sorry, that's the service that If you can't read a newspaper, you can call up and have a newspaper read to you. That was when federal funding was dropped about 4 years ago. It was picked up through the TAM fund under legislation. And then the rural captioning is $300,000 a year. So it's about 12% of the TAM fund a year. It would go to 16.5% if the additional $300,000 a year is approved.
Okay, and then so about the rest of the TAM fund is used for the original purposes, and would this, if this bill were to pass, would it interfere with your ability to do the other purposes, or it would just raise the charge?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it would, the TAM fee is capped at 20 cents, so right now we're at 6 cents, and our projection is it would go to 7 cents, so we're not hitting the cap.
And I guess it is a good reminder that we've strayed from the original intent of this beyond telephone usage several times in
this
previous.
This is not the first.
But, Senator Rest, this belongs in the state government division and should be funded there. It shouldn't be funded in this fund. I mean, I think Ms. Wells has a point. but it's not the first time that we have strayed from that original purpose. I mean, it's not really fair that only people who have telephones would be paying for all of these information services. I think her point is well taken. Have you talked to Senator Betzold about trying to find funding for these programs?
Madam Chair, the bill was introduced with the source of funding from funds, and the bill has been heard in the state government finance, and then it was referred here. I do think that there is a strong case to be made for an exception for the use of these funds because Minnesota does not have these standards for technology accessibility. And I guess I would also point out that 10% of the people in Minnesota fall into the category of the people who are would be benefiting from access to the information that is provided by state government, which they do not have at this point, and that I guess I would make the case that this is an appropriate departure for the TAM funds, and it was my understanding that also there had been a carryover of $2 million this year. Maybe I'm mistaken in that. In the TAM funds, and so that, and there is already a provision in the funding for captioning in the statute.
Ms. Hartnett.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we came before you with this legislation this year because we have worked as a committee. There was a voluntary ad hoc committee that worked for 2 years to try to get these standards introduced on a voluntary basis, and that didn't occur. We continue to get more and more complaints about people who are not able to access state government services. Target Corporation just settled a lawsuit back in the fall for $6 million because their website wasn't accessible. The National Federation for the Blind has lodged two lawsuits against two other states because their websites aren't accessible. We have their support for this bill, along with the American Council for the Blind, along with the Minnesota Association of Deaf Citizens. We're representing a broad-based coalition of people with disabilities. As the lawsuits have just been introduced, and there is within the last year, and there's just a trend. I think the state is at risk at this point for not providing it. We knew that the state is facing a great deficit. I know this is a source of last resort. I understand that. But I do think that the timing with all of this, with the lawsuits that are being lodged against other states that have been successfully lodged against Target Corporation just recently, I believe it was in September of 2008, that's why we identified this source of funding for one time for a two-year pilot to try to access these services.
All right. Thank you. Obviously, it's a really critical function that we should be providing for the citizens of our state. And, if you can't access government information, then you don't have access to government and you can't participate in democracy. And so it's wrong not to provide that. I agree. I just think it should be provided by general tax revenue. This is something that should be part of our general delivery of tax of government services. So I guess the committee will have to consider whether we think we should fund it through the TAM fund. Senator Rest, we're trying to determine if the rest of your bill could pass. I mean, is it contingent on the funding or not? Because we could separate out your language and send that on its own and just lay the funding, the appropriation section on the table. Or if it is contingent on the funding, we'll just keep the whole bill here. So I guess that's – what's your opinion on that? Perhaps this wouldn't
Madam
work
Chair,
without the funding.
Madam Chair, at this point, I guess if you wanted to take the Section 15 out and leave that here and send the bill on, I think I'd rather work with it that way, but still keeping the possibility for it. In particular – captioning is called for in the statute as a requirement, and I think that's the most critical feature in terms of the funding to make sure that happens. So at least that one section with regard to captioning, I think, is...
Which section are you on? Number two, the second appropriation? I don't... For the website? It doesn't... I don't see captioning listed there.
I think she's talking about the live streaming for the legislative...
Are you talking about the live streaming of legislative... Not
the it is the section.
I would include captioning.
Section three, I guess it is.
Okay. So, all right, but you're confident you can the bill can travel on its own without regardless of what this committee decides to do on the money.
If you are
confident, then we can certainly separate them out, and we'll be making a decision about the funding by Thursday.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I also would point out that part of the cost of the bill in terms of the preliminary estimate that was not corrected in the delete everything amendment that will be corrected at the next stop. It was just an inadvertent omission is to make sure that it is not retroactive, that it is only prospective. And Mr. Bodern was not just missed that in the delete everything amendment, but that will be added at the next stop so that it's not this retroactive impact, but only going forward. And that particular provision did not make it in the delete all amendment, although it was intended to do so.
What would the next stop be?
Finance.
Okay, so you'll have that amendment there?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Senator Fredrickson.
Madam Chair, I would move that the A7 amendment be adopted with the exception of Section 15.
Oh.
Section 15 be laid on the table for possible inclusion in the funding bill.
Okay. All right. So Senator Fredrickson moves adoption of the delete all amendment with the exception of Section 15 and that Section 15 be laid on the table for possible inclusion. On that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. And then Senator Fredrickson.
I'd move that...
1600.
That Senate File 1600 be recommended to pass, as amended, be recommended to pass and sent to the full committee.
All right. Any further discussion? Would anyone else like to be heard on Senate File 1600? All right. Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Committee is in recess till 6:30 tonight.